Binge Mode is brought to you by DirecTV Now. Live stream your favorite channels on virtually any device. Plus, you can subscribe to HBO and start watching Game of Thrones today. And now, a warning from our old buddy George.
Binge Mode contains adult content, much like Game of Thrones, the series adapted from my novels, A Song of Ice and Fire. If you have read the novels or have watched the show, then you're probably okay.
Come join us on the Cinnamon Wind. It's time for Binge Mode.
A sinner comes before you. Cersei of House Lannister. Mother to His Grace King Tommen. Widow of His Grace King Robert. She has committed the acts of falsehood and fornication. She has confessed her sins and begged for forgiveness.
Shame. 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 Shame.
Hello!
Yeah.
And welcome to Binge Mode. I'm Mallory Rubin, deputy editor of TheRinger.com. Joining me today,
yes.
Now that he's finished running Uncle Benjen's photo through Castle Black's facial recognition software.
He's back. No, is he? Let me go look.
It's Ringer staff writer and your maester, Jason Concepcion.
Hi.
Jason, we're here for the watch.
For the binge.
For the binge watch.
For the binge watch.
We are rewatching all 60 episodes of Game of Thrones. We're deep diving one at a time. And here we are at number 50. And boy, what
it.
A doozy it is.
A big one.
Oh,
big one.
That's a big episode. Spoiler warning, guys. We will be going deep on details from the show and the books from this episode and this season and beyond. And we are definitely going beyond this time. You have been warned. So steady your blade, thrust strong and true, because it's time to break down the cliffhanger-heavy, utterly stunning
Let's go.
Season 5 finale, Mother's Mercy. Jason?
Yes?
May I have the honor of presenting the newest member of the Kingsguard?
This guy looks familiar. Very quiet, man.
Memorable frame.
Where have I seen this guy before?
And may I have the honor of offering a brief refresher on what actually happened in this season finale by taking a quick trip down our very own King's Road. A lot of stuff. This is a big one.
Finale. On the march to Winterfell, the storm is cleared. The ice is melting. Mel's sacrifice of Shireen worked, or maybe weather just kind of moves around on its own and does its own thing. Who can say? Either way, the cost has been severe. Shireen is dead. Queen Selyse hung herself. And half of Stannis' army is like, yo, fuck this guy. And Melisandre, as soon as she hears that news, her face drops. She finds the only horse, I think, left in the fucking whole place and rides for Castle Black.
Such a great point. No one else has a horse. I have a question.
Yeah.
A leech, in theory.
Right.
Brought down a king.
In theory.
A second leech, in theory,
sure.
Brought down a second king.
Right.
You know, in the books, it's 3 for 3 at this point.
Right.
In the show, we're 2 for 3. Spoiler alert.
Spoiler. Guys.
Killing your own daughter just melts the snow.
I know, that's it.
That's the trade-off.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like there's a... It doesn't scale.
What?
It doesn't really scale.
Why?
Okay, I have to continue. Take this up with Melisandre's support line. Winterfell. Sansa takes advantage of the distraction of Stannis' oncoming army to light the candle in the tower. But Brienne, who literally has one fucking job, doesn't see it because... I don't know. She wanted to run through the woods. She went in search of Stannis and the oath and all that shit. Stannis' army is wiped out. Brienne finds him wounded.
Can you make the sound that he makes?
Yeah. He takes down two Bolton men. One of them cuts his ankle or his calf, and he's leaning against a tree, and he goes, "Gah!" And then he just calms down, propped against a tree, I guess considering his next move, and Brienne comes up. Says, "I'm Brienne Tarth. I was Kingsguard's Renly Baratheon. You know your fucking brother." And Stannis admits, "Yes, I used blood magic to kill my brother Renly. Now do your duty." Stannis tells Brienne, and she does. Whap. R.I.P. King Stanny Sr. Baratheon. One of the worst dads we've ever seen. But a decent battle commander, usually.
He sucked.
Yeah. Miranda confronts Sansa as she's coming from the tower. She's got her bow and arrow knocked and aimed at her, and she's threatening her quite clearly. And Theon finally emerges from the husk of reek, picks up Miranda, throws her, sorry, Adam, down into the yard, her body pinwheeling against the cobblestones. And then he and Sansa escape by jumping off the castle battlements into the snow.
Sure hope there was a lot of snow.
Yeah, that'd be fine. They were right.
And yet there was none by Stannis.
Right.
It all melted.
The melting. The great melting. We did it.
In Braavos, Arya uses the face of a young girl to get close. Very, very close.
Quite close.
To Meryn Trant, and crosses him off her list in brutal, savage fashion. Jaqen, not pleased with this development.
No.
Catches Arya returning the face. He knows that she killed Trant without permission. Has not yet completed her other actual assignment. He drinks poison to pay for the life that she took. It's not really him. A little, like, kind of cool, a lot of face pulling.
Right.
But then there's her face, and it's like, but she's not dead.
Right.
Or how'd they peel her face off? Oh, maybe something else is going on here. And then Arya goes blind.
Yep.
Okay. Things are getting weird in Braavos.
In Dorne, as their ship sails off for King's Landing, Jaime and Myrcella share that heartfelt father-daughter moment that is the danger sign for any character in King's Landing, the sun shining through the windows. And then a dribble of blood comes out of Myrcella's nose and she drops dead. Poisoned by the sand snakes. Long farewell indeed. This is war.
Never hug your children on this show.
Don't do it. Never.
Never. In Meereen, Dany and Drogon have not returned. Where are they? Well, let's go find them. Her advisors, plus Jorah, discuss what to do next. The decision. Dario and Jorah, two of my favorite dudes.
Yeah.
We'll search the Dothraki Sea for their queen, Tyrion.
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 We'll stay and rule the city with the help of Grey Worm. And hey, Missandei, you're welcome to contribute too.
Yeah.
Tyrion's thinking, standing out there, looking from the top of the pyramid, Mullen, and who should appear but Varys? Ah,
yes,
old
perfect
friend.
In the Dothraki Sea, Drogon is tapped out. Guy's been flying. He needs to sleep. He had spears in him. He's tired. And he's just ate a bunch of goats, and he just wants to lay there. He doesn't want to fly. "My people need me," Dany says. And Drogon's like, "Yeah, I'm going to sleep." Dany goes for a walk and is captured by a horde of Dothraki, but not before Lord of the Rings shout out. She takes her brooch, drops it on the ground as a sign for those who will be looking for her.
In King's Landing, shit is getting really real and also all over Cersei. She confesses, to one sin.
Yeah, it's one out of four?
The Queen Mother vigorously denies the rest of these charges, particularly the charge of incest. Of course, she has to deny that because Tommen's claim to the throne rests on her denying that. She asks for just one drop of the mother's mercy. It's the same thing that Jason and I ask for at the end of every binge mode recording session. Just one drop, Zach. Just one. The High Sparrow allows Cersei to return to the Red Keep, but nothing's easy, guys. Nothing's free. She has to take a walk of atonement, a not so lovely stroll through the hostile streets of the capital, naked, her blonde hair roughly shorn. She walks barefoot across the city under a storm of insults and spit and trash and feces and broken bottles and God knows what else.
It's really bad.
From the Sept of Baylor all the way to the Red Keep. Septonella is walking behind her, ringing a bell, chanting, shame, shame, shame.
She's enjoying it too.
Launching memes.
Yes.
Memes.
Many, many memes. Memes. Memes.
Finally, Cersei arrives at the Red Keep, collapsing into Qyburn's arms.
Qyburn, your grace.
He introduces the newest member of the Kingsguard, who carries her away for treatment.
But Castle Black.
Oh, boy.
John tells Sam.
Oh, no.
What happened at Hardhome?
Oh, God.
Sam tells John about Gilly and the baby and his feelings for them. And, oh, yeah, I got laid. John agrees to let Sam go to the Citadel to read and to fucking safety far away from the White Walkers. Davos arrives and begs Jon Snow for help on Stannis' behalf. Just then, Melisandre arrives at Castle Black, signaling for all those who know what to look for, the end of House Baratheon. Jon, later on, is reading letters in his solar when Ollie comes in with big news. Hey, man, I was talking to these wildling dudes, and one of them's like, Benjen, yeah, I know that guy. Come out here. You got to talk to this guy. And Jon's like, great. I'm coming out. I can't wait to talk to this guy. Goes out there, goes to where there's a circle of brothers and they're talking to that wildling guy. And wait, actually, no, it's a sign that says traitor. Give me those bells, Zach. Bang, bang, bang,
bang. For the watch.
For the watch. Jon Snow is assassinated by his brothers. Ollie with the Brutus dagger. The very end saying for the watch. His little fucking screwed up face, his lip quivering and sadness, but he really wants to do it. You know, fuck that guy.
Jon Snow has fallen. Let's take a moment, as we sometimes do, to talk about the way an episode was received at the time.
Yes.
This is not, you know, as long ago, obviously, as Baylor or Blackwater. Right. This is more recent history by Throne standards, but this was maybe the most upset people have ever been about anything. With a caveat.
Right.
No one really believed it.
Well, can I ask you, what were your thoughts the first time you read this chapter in Dance?
Devastation.
Yeah.
Despair.
Right.
So the way the chapter ends
is
it's a little different. We'll get into that a little bit later. It's a little different. There's like a throat slash.
Yeah.
There's a dagger to the gut.
Right.
John pulls it out. He falls. And then the blade goes in between his shoulders. And then the line is like, he never felt the fourth blade.
Right.
Only
right.
the cold.
Right.
And then that's it.
Right.
So you don't know definitively that he's dead, though it is certainly extremely bleak.
Right.
At that point, I was just so fully convinced that John was the hero of the story that I could not accept.
Right.
For even a moment that he was really, truly dead for good.
Right.
I thought, okay, well, maybe he's just not dead at all.
Right.
Like, he's had injuries before. He'll be fine. I thought, okay, no. What is all this resurrection stuff for? What's the point of all of it? Also, if you parse the prophecy closely, born again.
And there's a lot of other stuff, like when Bran has his three-eyed raven dream high above the earth, and he's looking north, and he looks to the wall, and he sees John, and the wording is that he's sleeping on a bed of ice, his skin growing cold. There's all these things that foreshadowed this. And while I, after reading it, was like blind with rage and sadness for like a day at least, I quickly came to the place of, wait a second.
Right.
Like, just in terms of how you build stories from a structural standpoint, you can't do this.
Right.
You couldn't do it.
Right. It was a little similar to me to something I've mentioned before that Zach has cut out of a podcast.
I know exactly what you're going
to say. Snape killing Dumbledore.
Exactly. Yeah.
I literally, for the first two nights, couldn't sleep because I felt, this will make me sound like a crazy person, but I mean this sincerely.
Right.
I felt like I had been betrayed by someone actually my life.
That's how I felt about, this is how I felt about this.
Right. And exactly. And there are very few things that have ever made me feel that way in literature. Even The Red Wedding had the same shock value for me, but I was just not as attached to Rob as a character
100%.
Because he's not a point of view character in the books. You frankly, I just haven't spent that much time with him at that point. The myths, the prophecies, they all align so much more clearly with John. And the reason I bring up the Snape thing is because 2 days of blind rage, of despair and devastation, less about Dumbledore's death than about Snape's actions. And then I thought, oh, no, if I go back and think of every single thing that's happened here, it all builds to what this was really about. And more importantly, what it's setting up.
Right.
And that's the thing with John, is ultimately he had to die because then he could be reborn.
Exactly. Now, getting back to what you were saying about how this was received by audiences, how mad they were, I think it was a little better for, it was clearly objectively better for the TV audiences because they had the book readers in a sense to fall back on to go, listen, we've been thinking about this for 2 years, 3 years, 3 years at that time. And it's like, he's going to be fine. Don't worry about it. He's going to live.
They tried so hard to make you believe.
They really tried. I mean, shouts to them. They tried.
They really, 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 really tried.
They tried so hard.
Really, really tried. Okay.
Mal?
Yeah?
You're no one.
That's rude.
You're nothing.
That's just hurtful.
And that gets us to this episode's big idea. So let's cut right to the core of it by sticking it with the pointy end. The defining theme of this episode is hatred. John's assassination. Listen, this is...
tough stuff.
This is a pure example of hatred. The people who killed John hate the wildlings more than they love their oath. You know, John and Sam are chatting, and John is extremely upset about the lives that were lost at the Battle of Hardhome. And he says, you know, the first Lord Commander in history to sacrifice the lives of sworn brothers to save the lives of wildlings. How's it feel to be friends with the most hated man in Castle Black? And John really now, feeling the weight of his decision, it's interesting to wonder if it would have actually been better or worse had he come back with 50,000 wildlings instead of 5. Sam, conversely, is showing a newfound confidence that comes when a wildling girl rides you through the night. He knows his worth, and he knows it because, yes, he's killed a White Walker. Yes, he's killed a Thenn. But he's been contributing important information that people would not have known, and that's what he's good at. He's found his place in the world, and he knows further that in order to continue that path, he needs to go to one place, and that's the Citadel, where he can continue his maester's training, where he can so he can replace Aemon at the Wall, so he can be around more books than he's ever seen in his life and learn how to defeat the White Walkers. And
loves to read.
Great pitch from Sam. He says, I'll learn about history and strategy and healing and other things, things that'll help when they come. For John, this is a fraught moment because, you know, Gren is dead, Pip is dead, Master Aemon is gone, dead.
Yeah.
Send Sam away, and now it's just Ed. And
love Ed, though.
I love
great, quick
listen,
with a zinger.
I love Ed, but you need your supporters around you. You need your truest friends around you. And John's about to lose that. He says, I need you here, Sam. If you leave, who's left to give me advice that I trust?
Very sad. That's actually, it's a very vulnerable moment for John.
Extremely. And also, like, how mature is this guy right now? Because he's come to a, remember, like, season one, you couldn't tell John shit.
Extremely arrogant.
Yes. And now he's like, who can I ask about things? I need to ask people things. I need you here. But Sam doesn't want to wind up hating himself before he dies because, you know, Sam has been saying over and over for this season and a little bit of the previous one that he just needs to protect Gilly. He feels the need to do that. And he says, if Gilly stays here, then she'll die. And the baby that she named after me will die. And I'll end up dying too, trying to protect them, which means that the last thing I'll see in this world will be the look in her eyes when I failed her. And John, you know, as much as anyone in this world, certainly as much as anyone in this castle understands that. Thank God there's still a little time for some humor. John, keenly aware of the musk of sex coming off his buddy Sam, says, you know, the Citadel will make you swear off women too. And Sam says, oh, they'll bloody try.
So so great.
Whoa, Sammy.
Oh, man.
And John gives him a look. Like, whoa, whoa. Where'd this guy come from?
Things are so dark and tense right now. And that moment, one of the things I love about it so much, other than the really pure humanity of it, mm-hmm. is the callback to season one. The scene
yeah.
where they're in the
Absolutely.
they're brushing the tables in the mess hall
yeah.
and they're talking about Roz and her turnips.
Huge, huge turnips.
And it's just nice that basically at the edge of the end of the world, they
right.
can take a moment to talk about
yeah.
love and relationships and turnips. So now we should talk about the scene that.
Oh, man.
Launched 1,000 spoilers.
It really did.
And theories.
People flipped out.
They were not happy.
They were. I would be unhappy as well.
It's kind of funny, though, because there was a really long period of time of, like, show watchers.
Yeah.
You like John?
Right, right.
He's so emo.
And part of it was that. And credit to Kit Harington. He grew into the role and got better as an actor over the course of the series, right? And there's not a lot of emotional range to John over the first two seasons of the show. And additionally, Kit was not really exploring that space all that well either. But he's, you know, he's like legitimately good as a craftsman now. And I think, you know, it just became, I think at a certain point, especially early on, it just became de rigueur to shit on Johnny Snow.
Right. Love John.
Yeah, I love him. Love he's John. Great.
John's at his desk.
Yeah.
We see clearly Longclaw, his Valyrian steel sword, yep. positioned right behind him, perched against his office wall.
Mm-hmm.
Useless. Useless to him. Not on his side, in his hands.
Gotta have it on you.
Ghost, his direwolf, not with him either.
Right.
Penned up. The weapons that could have saved John are just cast aside.
Right.
And that is not something a person in a position of power can afford to do in a world filled with this much hate and this many dangers. When Ollie enters, he says, Lord Commander. Now, like one note, this dude hasn't spoken to you in
right.
like ages.
Except to glower at
won't
you.
Even see, won't even smile at you, but he's bursting in for
right.
a chat. Maybe antennae up a little
yeah,
bit
I
here.
Know.
It's one of the wildlings you brought back. Says he knows your Uncle Benjen. Says he's still alive. Using John's love for his uncle
so
against
low.
Him is so low, so cowardly, that it really curses these men, these mutineers who are making this decision and choosing this path. And John, he bites. You know,
yeah.
he runs down to the yard where Thorn then echoes Ollie's words. John makes his way to the edge of the yard where this assembled group of brothers awaits, and they clear a path for him. He walks through their ranks, and he sees the sign, traitor.
Right.
He turns around. Thorn drives a blade into his chest. For the watch, First Builder Yarwick. For the watch, Bowen Marsh. For the watch, a couple other dudes
right.
who...
We don't know.
We don't know. For the watch.
Right.
For the watch. John falls to his knees. And then this is the moment that Ollie Cam has been building to.
Et tu, Ollie.
They just look at each other. And John, you can see the life is draining out of him already. And he can barely get the word out, but he says it. Ollie. And Ollie stabs him. And he says, for the watch. And the camera switches to an overhead shot. And John's eyes are open. They're staring
right.
wide open. And the blood is pouring out of him, black as night on the snow. One of the things that was cool about this, you know, we mentioned the number of theories earlier.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, a lot of people really honed in on Melisandre
yep.
and resurrection. Oh, why did she have that conversation with
right.
Thoros? Okay, she's going to try this. She's heading. Why is she heading back to
right.
Castle Black? She needs to be there for this. Okay. So people were looking for any possible clue that they could hold on to. And a lot of people.
The shape
yes,
that it made
in the
snow. Yeah.
This was just a great time on the internet.
It was fantastic.
It really was a great time on the internet. I'm kind of sorry that it's over.
It was great.
The mutineers who gave us this great moment. I mean, terrible. Terrible. Oh, but great, if I may quote Ollivander. They would argue that they were fighting to defend their mission as
right.
Swarm Brothers, that they were pursuing something sacred here, that they were actually protecting
right.
their oath. But the truth is, of course, that they completely and utterly corrupted it. They forswore themselves. They betrayed their Lord Commander. By the way, the second consecutive Lord Commander
Bad
of the
times.
Night's Watch.
Bad times for the Watch, guys.
Killed by his own men. I mean, the reputation of the Watch already, not to mention the actual the logistics that they're facing there, the number of men that they have, but just the reputation already. Hogwash.
Yeah.
And now, mutiny after mutiny.
Yep.
Not great.
Not great. Arya in the brothel. You know, remember back in season two when Arya first witnessed what Jaqen was capable of and she desperately wanted to know, how do I become that? How do I do that? How do I become a faceless man and kill as silently as a poison and as efficiently as Death's Scythe itself? But that knowledge was really what? Just a vehicle for her to achieve her goal, which is to kill the people she hates, the people who harmed her, her family, her friends. Remember season two. So Arya is after Jaqen has helped her and her friends escape. She asks, you know, how did you kill those guards? Was it hard? Jaqen's like, no. No harder than taking a new name if you know the way. And Arya says, show me how. I want to be able to do it too. And now here she is. She's at the house in Black and White. She is training with Jaqen or whoever this guy is. She's learned not a lot, but she's learned enough, certainly enough to become a dangerous person. She's learned how to observe, how to, at least in a cursory fashion, pretend to be someone else. And on that cusp of learning these deathly arts, which she so richly coveted, she sees something that brings her back to her original driving force of her life, which is her hatred for the people who harmed her, and it's Meryn Trant. And in that moment, all the other concerns become secondary. It's one thing to train to become a better killer in order to go out, cross names off her list, but what happens when your list comes to you? When your list comes to you, that's an opportunity that's too good to pass up. And Arya says when... You know, she's already stabbed Trant's eyes out. And he's
so violent.
He's fucking moaning. And she says,
She stuffs the gag
in his mouth. She says, you were the first person on my list, you know, for killing Cyril Pharrell. Remember him? Probably not. I've gotten a few others. The many-faced god stole a few more from me. I'm glad he left me you. Do you know who I am? And Trant is just gagging. He has no eyeballs, as I said. He's got that dirty rag in his mouth. Arya stabs him in the stomach. I'm Arya Stark. Do you know who you are? And something like a realization spreads across Trant's face. He says, do you know who you are? You're no one. You're nothing. And it's interesting that Arya repurposes here the philosophy of the faceless men. Because, you know, according to the tenets of the House of Black and White, it's the assassin who becomes no one, right?
Right.
Driven by hatred, Arya's execution of Trant is the antithesis of the teachings of the Faceless Men. She isn't no one. She's Arya Stark. It's her victims who will be reduced to no one, nothing, just worm food. And that cannot be allowed to stand. Jaqen says, a girl has taken a life, the wrong life. And the wave, I was right about her. Shut the fuck up. You were. You're not ready, not at all. And she grabs Arya. Jaqen says, that man's life was not yours to take. A girl stole from the many-faced god. Now a debt is owed. And he takes out a vial of poison. Only death can pay for life. He drinks it and he dies. Arya screams, no, don't die. And it's interesting to consider why she's so upset. Now, she's not upset because Jaqen and her had some kind of friendship, but because she sees Jaqen as the path to the knowledge she needs in order to kill her enemies, right? And she desperately wants this. And the wave says, why are you crying? He was my friend. No, he wasn't. Didn't you listen to him? And Jaqen's voice comes from behind, and there he is again. Now, you know, and we are starting to realize now that Jaqen is a face, and who knows if he's really a person or when he lived or anything. And he says, he was no one, but if you're... Who's this? And no one at all, just as a girl should have been before she took a face from the hall. And Arya goes down, she pulls off Jaqen's face and another face and another face and another face and another face. And Jaqen says, the faces are for no one. You are still someone, and to someone the faces are as good as poison. She's still pulling these faces off. She gets her own face and this shocks her. And then she goes blind. She, you know, think of the hatred this act will cause Arya to feel. Losing her eyesight is nothing to her. Making her think she'd lost yet another person, that's a thing that Arya will never forgive. And the waif, of course, hates Arya just as anyone would hate a competitor who appears to be coming for their spot. It's hypocritical in a lot of ways. If she's no one, why does she feel pettiness and right. jealousy towards Arya, these base instincts? There's just a lot of hatred simmering under the surface of the House of Black and White. A
lot of hatred in Dorne as well, where the depth of Ilaria's venom is very evident.
Quite, yeah.
In Myrcella's murder, the young princess, completely innocent, as innocent as any Lannister can be.
Right.
She played no role in Oberyn's death. She wasn't alive when Elia and the children were murdered, when Elia was raped, but she is a Lannister. This is pure guilt by association. Right. And she's also a portal for hurting the people who were responsible right. in some right. way. Or at least more directly responsible. Think about what Bronn said to Jaime when they were first sailing down and arriving in Dorne. I'm not sure you understand how much people hate your family in this part of the world. Not wrong.
Right.
Should have listened. Prince Doran warned in the previous episode that Ilaria would not get a third chance. And her murder of Myrcella is an open declaration of war. She's not going to, like, sneak this one by.
Right now. It's like, well, how did she die? I don't know. Who knows?
Maybe she ate one of Arya's oysters.
Yeah, could have been.
Could have been. Using poison also is basically a signature.
Yeah, but you're the fucking sand snakes.
Right.
You know.
But Ilaria doesn't care.
Mm-mm.
The snakes don't care. They hate the Lannisters more than they love their prince and much more than they love peace. Dorne has absorbed in their minds
right.
too many insults to go unchallenged. And Ilaria hates Lannisters and anyone who stands in the way. Extremely Stannis voice.
Is her foe.
We will come to see, spoiler alert.
Spoiler.
That Prince Doran is one of these people.
Stannis.
Stanny. Stanny. Papa.
Papa Stanny and Melisandre. There's that one moment that opens the show and it's like the icicle is melting and the sky is no longer clouded over. There's a kind of purple hue in the sky as it's cleared out. And Melisandre is like, yo, this shit works. And she goes up to Stannis. The Lord of Light has made good on his promise, my king. His fires have melted the snows away. The way ahead is clear. The Lord has shown me Bolton banners burning. You will receive what is yours by right. Oh, except like half the army deserted overnight. What? All the sellswords with all the horses. And that, well, except for the one that Melisandre rides the Castle Black. And what's that? There's more. Some guy comes running up to Stannis, your grace. And Stannis is like, what? Speak up. It can't be worse than mutiny.
Well.
And he goes over to a copse of trees just on the edge of the campground. And there is his wife, Queen Selyse, hanging from a tree. But wait, there's more. All of a sudden, another Baratheon soldier comes running up. He says, the Lady Melisandre was just seen riding out of camp. On what? The fuck was she riding on? Where is she hiding this horse?
What a dagger.
I mean, it's like, and the look on his face is like, oh.
Right.
I fucked up, didn't
I? So it wasn't me.
Right.
So none of this was real.
Right.
None of this was right. And I sacrificed literally everything.
Yep.
My family, my humanity, my soul.
Yep.
I'm going to lose anyway. What was the fucking point? What a way to go.
And the thing is, he's not the only one. Melisandre fooled herself.
Yes.
That is the thing that is so seductive about visions in this world, in this show. You come to see the things that you want to see and you misinterpret them. And that's what happened to Melisandre. She knows in this moment, wow, I was wrong about something. I got something right, but the core of it, whatever the core of it was wrong. And she hates herself. She can't stand it. She chooses to ride to a place where, you know, Davos is there. And when she arrives, which is like the guy wants to kill her, and this is the only place she can think to go that's safe. Think about how desperate that is. And she arrives there looking like, oh, everybody, like it's all on her face.
Right.
Everyone's dead. John comes up. Stannis, Davos immediately. Shireen, the princess. And she looks at him and says nothing. And you just know. They're all dead. They're gone. Stannis Sr. knows all is lost, but he can't quit now. I mean, what he doesn't have options now. Now it is truly over. This is a dead end, he says to what meager amount of men remain to him. Get the men into marching formation onto Winterfell. We're going on foot. There's a great moment that cements the end here. You know, he's like, he snaps into general mode. Okay, get me the picket lines over here. And you men over there, archers, get your arrows ready. I want fire arrows ready. We're going to start the siege lines over here. The siege starts at dawn, man. And then a guy comes up and is like, actually.
Entire army's right there.
What's that?
Just like literally just right there. It's just right there.
And it's just, you know, five times Stannis's men, and they're all mounted on horseback, and it's over. It's a mirror scene, in fact, of Stannis's caravan sweeping over the king beyond the wall's wildling soldiers in the Battle of the Wall. And now Stannis is the guy on foot, surrounded, his army getting shredded all around him. And so the king who didn't want to be the king who ran ends up being the king who ran into the woods, wounded, defeated, still fighting. You know, we see here that Stannis could handle himself.
Yeah.
Wounded, he takes down two of Ramsay's troops, takes a wound in the leg, lets out that death rattle, and here comes Brienne with her GPS that is just, you know, you can just find Stanny seniors with this thing. And she walks up and delivers the vengeance that she's been waiting for, the justice, really, that she's been waiting to deliver since season one.
She finds Stannis propped against that tree, a shell of a man, and her hatred for Stannis, for what he did to Renly, who she loved truly and fully,
right,
has fueled her every step of the way. In pledging herself to Kat, in aligning with Jaime, in trying to pledge herself to Arya and then to Sansa, she never stopped fighting to see that hatred for Stannis through to the end.
Go on, do your duty.
Go on, do your duty. Slash. We don't see the blade hit. We don't see a body. Some small contingent people out there were thinking, oh, maybe it's misdirection. Maybe she, you know, pulls a John with Ygritte and misses. And maybe Stannis is still alive. Well, spoiler alert, he's not. He's not in season six. He's dead. She did it. Brienne fulfilled her pledge. In the books, Stannis is not dead yet.
No. Far from it, in fact.
Myrcella.
Still alive.
Not dead yet
still
in the
kicking.
Books. She's horribly disfigured.
It's bad.
Which is another thing entirely, really tough.
It was on accident, though.
I mean, yeah, is that going to...
I'm just saying, it was
gonna,
an accident. I'm just saying,
gonna make
like, they didn't carve her face.
Look less like a Picasso painting?
I'm just saying, it was an accident.
So a lot of changes. This is really the episode, I think, where book readers were like, okay.
Right.
I'm just in a different story
right,
now.
I'm in a different... There's no Quentin, who book readers will know is one of the gambits that Prince Doran had going, which was a kind of like half-hoped marriage betrothal shot in the dark to Dany and Meereen. Yeah, there's just a lot of changes. I mean, it's safe to say this is a completely different story now.
Right. Some of it is just plot acceleration and some of it is alteration.
Right.
Sansa and Theon, the other people who are up there while all this is happening.
Sansa, she's come a long way, as we've said numerous times, and you can see that when she grabs that corkscrew, planning clearly to jab it into someone's neck, and you know, if needs be, and she uses it to free herself later and light the candle. She's smart enough to realize, when looking down upon the battle from her tower perch, that I don't have much time. Clearly, this battle is going to be over real fucking soon. So I can't wait around for rescue. I have to figure this out. And she runs out of the tower, and there is Miranda, that psycho, armed with her bow and arrow. And Reek is right there in tow. Miranda orders her back to her chambers. Sansa won't budge. I know what Ramsay is. I know what he'll do to me. If I'm going to die, and this is heartbreaking, let it happen while there's still some of me left.
Agonizing.
Agonizing, and also... this is a new place for Sansa. This is a new thing for Sansa to be like, you know what? I'm ready. If this is what it is, I'm ready to go right now. And Miranda hates everything about Sansa. Sansa is highborn. Sansa is beautiful. Sansa is Ramsay's actual wife who will bear him children, who will carry on the Bolton name.
And worse than any of that, who doesn't want that.
Right. She is disgusted by all of it. And Miranda, who wants nothing more than all of those things, can't have it. And then so Miranda says, with this smile playing across her face. Die? Oh, who said anything about dying? You can't die. Your father was Warden of the North. Ramsay needs you. Though I suppose he doesn't need all of you, just the parts he'll use to make his heir until you've given him a boy or two. Chilling shit. And then Miranda draws her bow. And from somewhere deep inside the twisted body and soul of Reek, Theon emerges, grabs Miranda, throws her over the battlements. She goes tumbling down to the cobblestones and dies. And then a horn blows. Guess who's back?
Theon loves horns.
He, as we all know. Open the gates, we hear, and Reek knows what that means. He's coming back. Grabs Sansa's hand. They run for the outer wall, look down at the snow, at each other. Sansa's hatred for Theon is no longer the most potent force inside her. It's trumped by something like gratitude, something like a feeling of this is my chance to survive, to escape, and who knows what else. And they hold hands and they jump into a large snowbank, just as in the books, but it's not Sansa.
And again, we don't see them land. We don't
right.
know
we don't
if
know.
They're injured, if they're dead. A whole off season full of speculation right. here on so many storylines. Very smart move on the show.
Agreed.
Show's part, knowing that they were going to be entering the season that was in many storylines ahead of the book. Well, we might as well use the star advantage.
Right.
Let's really build suspense here. In Meereen, the main source of suspense is who's going to go looking for our queen? There isn't really hatred, true hatred here, the way there is in other storylines in this episode, but there's certainly tension and disagreement. Everyone has an agenda. Everyone has a different idea about what to do. And for reasons that will never fully make sense to me, everyone kind of ultimately just listens to Daario.
Voice of reason all of a sudden.
There is much disagreement about whether Jorah should be involved. And ultimately, Tyrion, who's pushing back on a lot of this, says, you know, fine, he can join us as long as he promises not to kill me in my sleep.
I love this.
Great line from Jorah. If I ever kill you, your eyes will be wide open.
I love that.
Oof, love that fire. Yeah. Ultimately, Daario and Jorah hit the road. And Tyrion stays behind with Missandei and Grey Worm to rule. Thankfully, Varys shows up in the nick
of
time.
How's he even get in? It's fine.
At which point, Tyrion asks him for some counsel. How to rule in a place pulsing with hatred. How to get control of this. Now the heroes are off to find her and I'm stuck here, Tyrion says, trying to placate a city on the brink of civil war. Any advice for an old comrade? Well, of course, Varys always has advice. Come on. Information is key. It's a little bit of a little finger line there.
Yeah.
You need to learn your enemy's strength and strategies. You need to learn which of your friends are not your friends. Tyrion says, if only I knew someone with a vast network of spies. If only. Grand old city choking on violence, corruption, and deceit. Who could possibly have any experience managing such a massive, ungainly beast? And then there's a very cute moment where Tyrion says, I did miss you. Varys says, oh, I know. These exchanges, particularly one before everybody set out on their respective missions, a good reminder that hatred actually can at times be a unifying force, just like it can be a dividing force. So before Jorah set out, one of the things that he said to Tyrion that's interesting and I think really resonates is, you're a Lannister. The queen intends to remove your family from power. And Tyrion's response to this is, and I intend to help her do it. They can rally behind their shared hatred of a common foe. What about those other Lannisters? What about our girl, Cersei?
Tough times for her. The High Sparrow, of course, has been very honest, which sets him apart from all the other power players in King's Landing. He's never been anything but honest and honest about his beliefs. He hates sin, whoever it is that is doing the sinning, be they noble, be they the queen, be they a commoner, he hates sin. His sins do not pardon your own, he says about Robert as Cersei kneels before him. He goes on to say, speaking falsehoods before the gods is a great crime. Do you understand this? About her denials originally when she had denied all these crimes that he had charged her with. And of course, she cannot admit to being with Jaime because it would delegitimize Tommen so much for, you know. Interestingly, the High Sparrow seems relieved by this. He says, good, good. But of course, there will be a trial. And he does believe in mercy. So when Cersei confesses, he grants her leave to return to the Red Keep. But it's not that easy. Sins must be scrubbed away. There will be a trial, and there must be a walk of atonement. Now, this is, it's an attack. It's violent. They shear her head like an animal. Her head's bleeding. They shave her body hair. And then they bring her out to the steps in like a just a rough spun cloth. And this is an agonizing sequence that goes on for a long time.
Very long.
Extremely long. And it starts out very bad and then just gets much, much, much worse. Of course, there are epithets. Cunt, whore, bitch, brother fucker, all hail the royal tits, like all these kind of things. And Cersei just wilts eventually under the weight of all this abuse. They're smearing shit on her shoulders. Someone's thrown her. She's bleeding after a while. They're throwing all manner of things at her. People are jumping out naked and spitting hate at her, spitting in her face. She's the queen. This is incredible. But as she appears broken, even as she appeared broken in front of the High Sparrow, this is Cersei Lannister. She is remembering all these things. There's a man that jumps out at her.
Making a list of her own.
Right, who waves his dick at her and says something. She'll remember that guy, Septa Unella, who she has threatened many, many, many times with many, many terrible things, including death, and who will find that there are worse things than death. She will not forget Septa Unella. She will not forget Marjorie, Olenna, the High Sparrow, Kevin. We know this, spoiler alert, from next season. Increasingly, as her children have been plucked away from her, you know, Joffrey is gone. Myrcella is dead. She doesn't know it yet, but Myrcella has been taken away from her to Dorne. Tommen, no longer under her influence. The place in her that was filled with love for her children has conversely filled with an equal amount of hate as they have been taken from her. And this is what is keeping her going at this point. And then when she enters the Red Keep, collapses into the arms of Kyburn. He presents her the Franken Mountain. Sir Gregor Clegane, man, does he look ominous with those dead gray eyes. And Kyburn says, if it please your grace, he's taken a holy vow of silence. He swears that he will not speak until all his grace's enemies are dead and evil has been driven from the realm. And then something like determination comes across Cersei's face, and she, in that moment, knows that she has to kill all these fucking people.
All of them. Jason?
Yeah?
I've sinned.
Uh-oh.
I see that now. How could I have been so blind for so long?
I'm not sure.
I want to be clean again.
Uh-oh.
I want absolution.
Okay.
I want to understand the family history.
Yes.
That makes Cersei's walk of atonement even richer.
It does.
So please, I beg of you,
yeah,
assemble the conclave, head to the Citadel, teach us everything we need to know about Tytos Lannister, his mistress, and her walk of shame through Lannisport.
Tytos Lannister, his mistress. Cersei is not the first woman associated with House Lannister to take a walk of atonement, a walk of shame. The first was the mistress of Tytos Lannister, Cersei's grandfather and Tywin's father. Later on in Tytos's life, after the death of his lady wife, Jane Marbrand, Tywin's mother, Kevin's mother, Lord Tytos took a common woman to his bed. And we don't know what her name was, and that's probably exactly how Tywin wanted it to shake out. Lord Tytos, you see, was everything that Tywin was not. He was, in fact, everything that Tywin in his adulthood would despise. Tytos was amiable, trusting, quick to forgive. He loved jokes. Being liked was very important to Tytos. In a word, the Lord of Casterly Rock was soft. And in Westeros, then as now as ever, laxness is an invitation for trouble, all kinds of trouble. Tytos's amiable nature attracted sycophants and swindlers and people looking for handouts from the realm's richest men. It got so bad that his bannermen would make jokes to his face at court, at feasts, in front of the lords and ladies of the Westerlands. No, not good. And Tytos, wanting to be a good sport, wanting to be liked, would just laugh along with everybody else. Lords of the Westerlands, of course, took this as intense weakness. This guy has no fucking balls. So what did they do? hey, our liege lord is the richest guy in the realm. Let's borrow money from him and just never pay it back. Many lords took advantage of Tytos's open-handedness by borrowing gold that they had no intention of ever paying back to the Lannisters. And why the fuck not? All knew that Tytos did not have the spine to force the issue. One of the people who preyed upon Lord Tytos's open-handed personality was the woman who would ultimately become his mistress. Tytos, by this time, was elderly, quite obese. His self-esteem surely at a lifetime low. And then, just then, here comes this beautiful young woman, daughter of a simple candlemaker, to brighten the gloomy final days of his life. Who could blame the old guy? And they had only been together for a year when Tytos's mistress all of a sudden was feeling very safe in her station, feeling comfortable to fire long-serving household servants and to order Lannister knights to do this and that, all without the lord's leave. Quick-fingered, she wasted very little time in appropriating the late Lady Jane's jewels and finery. Tywin's mom's stuff. This lady is just going through, ruffling through. And worst of all, she presumed to speak for House Lannister at meetings when Lord Tytos was indisposed. A crude joke circulating around the Westlands at the time said that the best way to get an audience with Lord Tytos was to speak directly into his mistress's lap because, you know, that's where the vagine is. And of course, all of this much vexed Tywin. He hates this. This absolutely drove him fucking nuts. His own father, the Lord of Casterly Rock, the guy who's supposed to be taking care of the legacy of the Lannisters, had dangerously weakened their house, damaged their legacy, and really nothing that Tywin could do about it, not as long as Tytos lived, that is. Aside, one of the knock-on effects of Tytos's passivity was the ascendance and eventual rebellion of the Rains. Remember them? The Lords of Castamere. They, along with the Tarbecks of Tarbeck Hall, saw an opportunity that presented itself because of Tytos's general softness, and they renounced their fealty to Lannisters, rose in rebellion, and Tywin, acting totally without his father's leave, reduced both houses famously to ashes. Anyway, one day Lord Tytos was climbing the steps and his heart just gave out. Despite his disgust, and credit to Tywin, by the way, despite his disgust of the way his father was running the family, Tywin had respect for his father. He waited. But now with him gone, Tywin wasted absolutely no time. He seized the mistress, had her stripped naked, and made her walk through Lannisport like, quote, a common whore. Her days of influence were done. Ironic, then, that such a fate should one day befall his only daughter, Cersei.
Oh, Cersei.
Cersei.
Oh, Cersei. Hey, guys. Just a quick break to tell you about our sponsor. Binge Mode is brought to you by DirecTV Now. Live stream your favorite channels on virtually any device. Plus, you can subscribe to HBO and start watching Game of Thrones today. And now, back to Binge Mode. Maester.
Yeah.
My Valyrian is a bit nostril.
Quarth.
But let's not let that stop us.
Sure.
Let's head to the Sept to bathe in the light of the Seven by sharing seven of our favorite insights and observations from this episode. Lightning round style. You go first.
Number one, some serious Walker preparation and foreshadowing in this John Sam chat from this episode. John is like, he raised his hands and they all stood up at once, tens of thousands of them, the biggest army in the world. And Sam says, so what are you going to do? I'm going to hope they don't learn how to climb the wall, but the dragonglass, no one's ever getting that back now. It wouldn't have mattered anyway. It was like, Sam, it was like 30 blades. Okay, there's like, not unless we had a mountain of it. Aha, I know where there is such a place. And then Sam says, but you killed a White Walker. John, with Longclaw, I saw them shatter steel axes like they were glass. But Longclaw, Sam, is Valyrian steel. How many Valyrian steel swords are left in the Seven Kingdoms? John says, not enough. There's really not. There's like less than 10, probably. There is, of course, as I mentioned, a mountain or a cavern or several caverns of dragonglass under Dragonstone. Yes. And then gathering the Valyrian weapons, that's going to matter. Sam now has one. He has Heartsbane, the family sword of House Tarly. He stole it from his fucking dad's house above the fireplace.
Great stuff.
We know from the cover of Entertainment Weekly that Arya is running around with the assassin's blade that the assassin used to try and kill Bran. That's a Valyrian steel sword. Brienne has one. As for others, we don't know yet. We will see.
Number two, show change. We hinted at this earlier in the episode. Benjen being the ploy that draws Jon down into the betrayal zone. Does not happen in the book.
Nope.
It's not Benjen.
Nope.
There's a kerfuffle with a giant.
Right.
Some other stuff.
Right. The giant's getting mad. Come out here. He's going to kill somebody.
This is no accident.
Nope.
Spoiler alert for season 6. The show wants to remind us who Benjen is.
Yep.
That Benjen matters to some of these people before he comes back in his Cold Hands-ish role.
Right. Number 3. Bronn says farewell to Tyene. Oh, beautiful Tyene.
She looked great.
And she says, you want a good girl, but you need a bad pussy.
Wow. An insane line.
Wow.
That's a crazy thing.
I don't understand this line necessarily. it feels completely from a different show, but I respect that.
Oh, man. Impromptu Tywin is so great. Number 4. Man, from the humor of that to some dark, sad shit. The scene between Jaime and Myrcella, maybe it's not to your taste. There's a lot of hurried exposition before a big plot development.
Right.
Okay, that part, whatever. Agree to disagree.
Right.
The thing about that we can't really dispute is the utter agony of this. Think about this. This is the one moment in Jaime's entire life where he has gotten to live honestly and openly as a father to his children.
Sad.
And it is instantly ripped away from
him. It lasted about a minute and 15 seconds.
So brutal.
Number 5, in the throne room of Meereen, Tyrion, observing the tattered remnants of Dany's crew, says to Jorah and Dario, you love her, don't you? How could you not? Of course. It's hopeless for both of you. A sellsword from the fighting pits and a disgraced knight. Neither one of you is a fit consort for a queen. But we always want the wrong woman. And Dario says, Dario looks at Jorah and says, does he always talk so much? And Jorah just nods.
That's a great moment for a lot of different reasons. I love that. Number 6. Just want to talk a little bit about Drogon here. Extreme, major props to this dude for doing what literally every cat and dog in the real world does every day. Curling up for a freaking nap just when your mom or dad is trying to get you to do something else.
Right.
This string of pleas from Dany is so funny.
And it's pathetic, too, but it's funny in a pathetic way.
It's also very sweet, though, because she starts off, my poor sweet, because Drogon just flops down.
I know, right.
He's just on those goat
in
bones.
A heap.
My poor sweet thing. Does it hurt? He got fucking stabbed multiple times. How would you feel? And then immediately she goes full on into, we have to go home mode. We have to go home. Drogon?
Yeah.
Can you take me back to Meereen? I requested my lift minutes ago. How far did you take me? Drogon? And then she goes off, to get a sense of her surroundings, probably to look for a little bit of food, but walks right into the path of the Khalasar. And, lucky that she thought to drop that ring and lucky that it is some sort of GPS beacon because how else do these fuckers find this thing?
And this is the scene for book readers will know that it is suggested that Dany's
womb,
her womb is quickening.
Quickening. Is it quickening?
Perhaps.
Is it a quickening one?
Number 7, Dario. Speaking of Grey Worm, he says, he's the toughest man with no balls that I've ever met. What great stuff from Dario over the last 2 episodes. He's really come through. He's just been great over these last 2 episodes. We got to figure out a reason to get this guy over from freaking Meereen.
Looks good, too.
What's he doing in Meereen?
Looks good.
Get him over here.
Looks good.
Come on. Mal.
Yeah.
If you've given honest testimony, your trial will prove your innocence.
Well,
just
I hope so.
Ask this episode's winner. Each episode, we're going to honor the person who played the game and advance his or her cause in some tangible way. And this week, the winner of our champion's purse is the High Sparrow.
3 W's.
Big
for
season.
This guy.
Big season for the High Sparrow. Although, it's kind of like Cersei choked 3 times and gave it to him. You know what I mean?
Right.
He has establish his domination over the entire capital. He's got the heirs to Highgarden in jail. He's got a weak king who cannot deal with him. He has paraded the Queen Mother nude through the streets, essentially broken her power in his mind by embarrassing her in this way, although she will find reserves of hatred and resolve that cannot be broken by any humiliation that can be visited by a human mind upon another human being. Kevin with an A is forced to come back from Casterly to run the city. He has thrown this entire city into chaos, and it is chaos that he controls.
Someone told me something about chaos once.
I think it's it's not a pit.
It's that other thing.
It's like if what's the thing that you go up it?
They have one
right
in the Vale.
In the Vale, Eliza, and your aunt.
Well, friends,
yeah.
Now that you've seen more of the world, you've learned how complicated things
extremely
can be. We hope that you have had as much fun learning about those complications as we have, and that you will join us again next time when we enter the home stretch, final season.
Oh my God.
Please join us next time when we will be discussing season 6, episode 1, The Red Woman. Who could that be about?
Yeah.
Until then, just know we're glad, truly glad,
yep,
that the end of the world's working out well for someone.
Someone.
One of our best yet.
It was good.
Zach looks extremely unhappy.
That was 80 minutes, guys.
Let it go.
Thanks to our producer, Zach Mack, Colin Orca, Joe Fuentes, Isaac Lee, and of course, Bill Simmons.